Welcome back to the D-Fly and Dixie podcast featuring Big Ten Network, ESPN, and Inside Lacrosse analyst, my old buddy, Mark Dixon. I am your host, Dan Flynn. The event we have all been waiting for is finally here, the NCAA Division I Men's Cross Tournament. So much to cover, including an interview with our friend, Jerry Byrne, who earned a berth to the party in his first full season at the helm of the Harvard Crimson. Lots to talk about. So, Dixie, let's get it. It's on, Dixie. It is our NCAA tournament preview special edition. Let's go.
How you feeling?
I'm excited. I'm excited for the games this weekend. You know, I said it last week, all those teams deserve to be here, but now we've got the cream of the crop ready to play for a title. A title in a few weeks, Memorial Day weekend, will crown a champion. And while there's a prohibitive favorite in the Terps, they're gonna have their work cut out for them, and the games and the path to get there is gonna be fun, exciting, and always interesting.
It really is. It's an exciting time of year, and when you look at the complexion of this tournament, it's never looked different, in my opinion, in all of my years, in my 25 years of covering college lacrosse.
Go on.
This has never looked more different. No Hopkins, no Syracuse, no UNC, no Notre Dame, no Duke. And somebody made a, you know, I put up a post, I think it was something to that extent, and somebody said, you know, what do you mean Duke? They've just been good recently. Hey, guess what? Duke has just as many national championships as the University of Maryland in men's lacrosse. So this is a much different tournament, and it's either going to be an epic fail or it's going to be, wow, we still have a lot of pretty great cross teams who can get after it without a lot of the traditional powers being around. So it's going to be really interesting.
I don't see it being, there's any chance it's an epic fail. And I know you're just being bombastic when you say that.
I'm saying, I think, you know, the way the reaction has been to the field, to the selection committee, everybody thinks that this is going to be the worst tournament in the history of NCAA Division I men's lacrosse. So I'm just saying, I think we're going to be okay at the end of the day.
By what metric? TV eyeballs? I don't know. So let's start there. Let's start with, on Sunday night, a field of 18 teams was announced. You know, I think the controversy was Harvard and Ohio State got in, Duke and Notre Dame did not. So we're talking about two teams, really, that people, yes, you mentioned some of the blue bloods in Hopkins, Syracuse, North Carolina. Let's, like, well, the Greyhounds have been there many times. Like, there's a lot of teams who aren't, but I think it's great for the sport that there are new teams, new fan bases, new parts of the country that are represented in the field, and I'm excited as it begins a new tournament. I think there's, I have a different aspect of it. In terms of the teams that didn't make it, you know, the committee thought the Ivy League obviously had a great RPI and thought that that was the top league. In years past, that has been the ACC. This year, the Ivy League was, without a doubt, people considered it to be the top league. They got six teams in. Harvard, based on the logic of the committee, they beat two seeded teams in Brown and Princeton. And they beat another conference champ in Boston University. They have three wins over tournament teams and two over seeded teams. You look at the resumes of Duke and Notre Dame. Notre Dame's best win, they beat Duke twice. Those are their best wins. Duke is not in the field. Notre Dame, the argument was, and I don't understand this at all. I mean, Syracuse, they beat, of that six-game winning streak that everyone's talking about, of how they're ready to play for the national championship. They're a title contender. They're on a roll. They're ranked number four in the media poll, which, I disagree with this week, is because they beat Marquette, not in the field. They beat Duke twice. They beat Syracuse twice, and they beat North Carolina. No tournament teams there. You know who else won their last eight regular season games?
Tell me.
And also beat Duke this season?
Tell me.
Jacksonville. Jacksonville also has a win over two other RPI top 20 teams in Denver and Richmond. They didn't get in, and no one is really complaining about that. It was all this. The event was on ESPN. ESPN also runs the ACC network. Same broadcasters, same people who were doing the selection show, same voices that are predominant on Lax Twitter, and they were bent out of shape on Selection Sunday. And really, I mean, you can make an argument. Yes, they could have been included. And then, you know, Harvard and Ohio State wouldn't have gotten in. Harvard, again, I made their case. Some teams get in, some teams don't. And I understand that. Everyone's going to be angry. But to make a comments, and again, you were just relaying the general sentiment on Lax Twitter that this is going to be the worst tournament in the history of the NCAA because of the field, which really is just about two teams, really the Duke and Notre Dame thing, is ridiculous. Come on.
So that's a lot. And I understand how you feel and I get it. I understand, you know, look, I cover the Big Ten and I was on Saturday's show, the championship game between Maryland and Rutgers. And really when we talked about Ohio State, I was like, there's no way Ohio State cannot be in this tournament if you're going to give a bid to Notre Dame and or Harvard. Wins have to matter. Wins have to matter at the end of the day. And I think in large part, the combination of the RPI, strength of schedule, and then those quality wins for Ohio State eventually got them in. You can say the same thing about Harvard, whether it's good or bad. You know, the Ivies didn't have an alpha team the way the Big Ten does. They don't have a dominant team like Maryland. I mean, a couple weeks ago on this podcast, we talked about the Ivy League standings. Everybody was 3-2.
Yeah,
and then they, you know, all the tiebreakers that went into determining the four that got into the field to play in this past weekend at Brown. So, you know, there's a couple of things. One, this week it was telling how passionate Notre Dame fans are. I don't know if it's necessarily Notre Dame lacrosse, but Notre Dame in and of itself, man, those are some scary people. They went nuts on Twitter. I mean, you had media personalities. You had, I mean, how about Dookie V? Dick Vitale weighing in, putting in his 2 cents.
Whose grandson is going to go play lacrosse at Notre Dame too. And his children have gone there. And his son-in-law is he's got a lot of connections to Notre Dame. So
He does. But I'm just saying it went from there to just the, you know, the guy that you could probably peel off the bar stool on a Sunday night after a long weekend of just sitting there watching every sport and drinking every, you know, taking advantage of 2-for-1 or whatever. It was just a wide range of people.
It was.
There was virtually nothing out of Duke or in support of Duke, which leads me to believe that people just don't care about Duke lacrosse other than the athletes that play and the alumni and, or, you know, I don't even know about alumni. I didn't see or hear a peep out of the
I think
Duke.
That's because Duke lost to Notre Dame twice and they felt True. Like, look, if we don't have a case, if Notre Dame doesn't get in, then we don't really have a case either. So we should be quiet. I think that's the only reason. They had a better RPI. They beat a few other tournament teams, you know, throughout the season. But again, they had a couple of bad losses. They lost to Syracuse. They lost to Loyola. They lost to Jacksonville. None of those teams finished in the top 20 of the RPI. So, you know,
that's a good entree into Jacksonville. And Jacksonville could be not the same situation, but similar to Rutgers in 2016. That was a Rutgers team that beat Johns Hopkins twice, once in the regular season, once in the semifinals of the Big Ten tournament. Did not get into the NCAAs, but Hopkins did. What killed Rutgers that year was a terrible loss. And I can't remember who it was to, but it dropped their RPI to the low 20s or high 20s. And that ruined Rutgers. I think when you look at Jacksonville, their loss to Hopkins hurt. It didn't kill them, But what killed them was the loss to Utah. That crushed their RPI.
Again, Hopkins finished 21 in the RPI and Utah finished 23. If Utah had won their conference championship, there's who knows where that it could be. So yes, you're right. But you're saying those really, it's like the playing some of their own conference opponents is what crushes their RPI and drives it down. And again, they're in a league, the SoCon, where there's some, you know, some good teams in there, but there's some merging programs or, you know, that haven't gotten over the hump yet, and they drag their RPI down, and there's nothing they can do about it. That's the league that they're in.
I found one, it was a little frustrating. People were coming after me on social media on Thursday when we had Hopkins listed as a top 20 RPI win. On Thursday of last week, they were number 20 RPI. That counts, people. People were like, they're not even top 20. There were 21 after the fact. So, but that, you know, on Thursday, that was a top 20 RPI win. And we adjusted it accordingly. As far as the SoCon goes, that's an emerging conference, as you mentioned. People tout their abilities all the time. No one came to Jacksonville's defense. I didn't hear anything in Jacksonville's defense to have them included in the NCAA tournament, which I was surprised at. I thought maybe there would have been a little bit more support for the Dolphins. But again, that RPI, just, you know, the RPI was not competitive compared to the others. But, you know, the RPI of Ohio State being similar to or right around, I was going back and forth with Terry Foy over the weekend. I'm like, Ohio State's in. He's like, I don't think so. You know, and he was pointing to history and precedent, which is fair. The only other thing I'll say is the Ivy League this year was very similar to the Big Ten last year, with the exception they got to play out of conference. Big Ten didn't last year. So Maryland is the dominant team. Rutgers is pretty good. And the rest of the teams are just beating the crap out of one another. And the narrative became the Big Ten is down. The Big Ten isn't good, which was garbage. And you spin it to 2022 and you look at the Big Ten, you know, obviously Maryland is the alpha. Rutgers gets questioned for playing not that great of a schedule, but they still finish with an RPI of 6. And then you have, you know, Hopkins wasn't good. What?
They were 5. Rutgers RPI was 5.
Okay. My bad. Even better. Hopkins wasn't good. Michigan struggled. But you had Ohio State beat Notre Dame, North Carolina, Harvard, Penn State beat Yale. And they were, what, 3-11, 3-12? You know, that was a team just decimated with injuries. But still, a 3-12 or 3-win.
3-11.
Yeah, 3-win Penn State team beat Yale and played Penn to 1 goal and Cornell to 1 goal. So what I'm saying is, like, the benefit of that the Ivies got this year, the Big Ten didn't get last year. But what saved the Ivies was their out-of-conference wins. Helped them a lot. I see you shaking your head. Are you agreeing or
no? No, I'm saying that it's more than saved them. It thrust them to the top of like an unprecedented 6 bids for the Ivy League this year. I mean, it was just their strength of schedule, who they played, who they beat early in the season, just catapulted them. So then, I mean, you've seen this when in the NCAA basketball tournament, when a mid-major conference sort of beats the RPI by winning a couple games. And then as they play their league games, it just raises up every other team's RPI within the league. And then, you know, they end up just like helping themselves. Even if you lose a game, it doesn't really matter because this team is really good. And we saw that. And look, there was a lot of, you know, we have to change the system. And I'm like, oh, okay. Like, I think there could be some more consistency. The sample size is small. A lot of these teams do play each other. So you get this like circular logic, like, well, Notre Dame didn't beat anybody in the field. What if Duke had made it and they had a 7 RPI? We talked about why Duke maybe shouldn't have made it because of some of their losses. Well, then Notre Dame has a win, 2 wins over a team that's in the field, you know? So it's like, oh, well then that catapults them up. So there is this circular logic. I understand that. I get that because there's only 70 three teams. But if it was bigger, you know, I get that. But you have to go by something. And I really don't think, you know, there were a number of automatic qualifiers, a lot of them, and then they had to pick the other handful of at-large selections. And really, I guess people are complaining about really one team not getting in. Doesn't that happen every year? So I think that, I want to say there were some people who embarrassed themselves. I mean, that's too strong of a word, but there were people who said some inappropriate things on Sunday night publicly through Twitter. And it just, you know, who are public figures who work in the lacrosse business or in the broadcasting business. And it just seemed really out of line for the night. I understand you can share your opinion. You can be like surprised that certain teams don't make it or certain teams do make it, but that's where you should draw the line, is being surprised. You know, my favorite Lax Twitter thing, just to, you know, wrap it up from my standpoint, if you have an extra comment, go for it. But is on the PLL draft on Tuesday, people were like, well, why didn't the Ivy League have the top eight picks? You know, you'd expect that, you know, they're so good this year. Why did they? And you're like, come on.
Yeah,
that's not how this works.
Well, I did see one funny tweet, and it was, "Hey, you guys forgot Dartmouth." that was kind of funny.
Yeah, I don't think Dartmouth feels being left out of the yeah, NCAA right. tournament. I mean, no one's worried about the feelings of the players and coaches at Dartmouth.
Yeah. You know? So there's you hit on a couple things. One, expansion in the NCAA tournament. I had a chance to talk to Ed Lee of the Baltimore Sun this week about that. We need to be more focused on increasing the number of Division I teams at this point than expanding the tournament with only 73 men's Division I teams. We need to get that number up to 90, 100, because if you look at the ratios right now, NCAA men's lacrosse is at 25%. Men's basketball, I believe, is at 20%. Women's lacrosse has, what, 28 teams make it, but they have 118 Division I women's lacrosse. So we have to look at ourselves and say, why is that? You know, we need more schools in the Big Ten to pick up lacrosse. We would love a formation of the Pac-12 in men's lacrosse. That's the first thing. For Notre Dame, I think maybe the lesson is maybe play more games. Potentially, I mean, only what were they, 8-4?
8-4, yeah.
12 games, and maybe, you know, light on two or three games compared to other schools, and particularly with Notre Dame not having a conference tournament. The ACC doesn't have a conference tournament right now. Maybe want to play more games. I understand it could be a challenge in South Bend with weather, especially in the February, March timeframe, but maybe examine that a little bit. You're right, Duke. I mean, yeah, the RPI is great, but you got to look at the record. You got to look at the body of work. People talk oftentimes about the eye test. That's all well and good, but we talk about this a lot here in this space. This is a lot of week to week type things where one week Duke looks like world beaters, and the next week they can't even connect passes. So eye test is more like, when did you see the team play? The other thing I would say is, do I think Notre Dame's a tournament quality team? Absolutely. Yeah, sure. And if they were in this thing, could they make it to championship weekend? Absolutely. But you have to take care of your business. You know, that's kind of like going to your teacher after you get, you know, after you flunk a test or you get a D and be like, let me take it over again. And I'm this time, since I've already seen all the questions, I'll, you know, but what I'm getting at is I'm kind of out of the business of saying this conference is down. I'm more of the lines of this conference is just playing better. And in 2022, overall, the body of work, it's kind of hard to argue to say that the Ivy League's body of work wasn't better than the ACC's. The Big Ten's too, potentially. I just think that there's too many good athletes. There's too many great lacrosse players. There's too many great coaches to say this league is down. I just think that's a narrative that needs to be put to bed. I think the other thing is we have to stop projecting conference bids in March, in early March in particular, handicapping leagues. I don't know. I just think that's unhealthy, and it can get you in trouble when you come down the stretch. The final thing that I'll say is the NCAA tournament committee, you talk about Notre Dame winning six in a row to end their season. Remember, you can't cherry pick your results. It's the beginning of the year to the end of the year. And that win in February can be just as big as that win in May. The loss in February could hurt just as much as a win could cancel a May win out. It's the entire body of work. So I'm not a big fan of the argument. You know, Notre Dame might be one of the hottest teams in the country. Yeah, okay. But, you know, they did lose some games earlier in the season. Georgetown is one of them. They lost handily to the Hoyas. And yes, teams, is Notre Dame the same team they were in February? No team is the same as they were in February, whether it's for the good, for the better or worse. But it's that entire body of work that's taken into consideration. I know there's a lot to unpack here. There's a lot of emotion, but I'm looking forward to a great tournament. ESPN's going to have the coverage. The weather in the Baltimore area is supposed to be rainy on Saturday, which is a great excuse to be a slob and just sit on the couch and catch the games. But I'm excited. But I think when people have this level of passion, and you're right on the, you got to be appropriate about it. I mean, especially
professional,
especially when you're an adult. You know, I mean, yeah, yeah, I'm with you on that. But isn't it cool to see the passion that we have in this game?
Yeah, it really is.
I mean, it's for the most part, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is. You know? It is. Well, let's start with the games. So the tournament kicked off on Wednesday evening with two games. First rounder is playing games, whatever you want to say. They're NCAA tournament games, and they count as Ws.
No question.
So there were two lopsided games. And we'll start with Vermont 15, Manhattan 3. The Catamounts got great efforts from several players. The Big Macs. Michael McCormick, 5 goals, 1 assist. Thomas McConvey had the same line of 5 goals and 1 assist. Goalie play was great. Ryan Cornell, 13 saves, only gave up 3 goals. And then the faceoffs were just an outstanding performance by Tommy Burke. He won 19 out of 21. Faceoffs and picked up 13 ground balls to lead the Catamounts to an NCAA tournament win over Manhattan.
Playing games are tough, and congratulations to the Jaspers and the Catamounts. Jaspers especially, first ever appearance in the NCAA tournament, won the MAC championship. First of all, you're on short rest, big time, after both of them had tough conference tournaments. And I think in this game, Vermont's experience, having been here before, was really helpful in addition to being at home. And they're a very talented lacrosse team. So now we get, for the second year in a row, an NCAA first-round matchup of Vermont versus Maryland.
In the second game of the evening, the University of Delaware just took it to Robert Morris. It was 19-4, I think. We were watching the game, and the Blue Hens were putting on some SportsCenter-type highlight goals. Final score was 20-8. Outstanding performances from the Hens, from J.P. Ward, 7 points, 5 goals and 2 assists. Mike Robinson at 6 points. Drew McKaitis had 4 points, as well as Clay Miller and Ty Kurtz for the Hens. And really, just they romped.
Cuckoo-cachoo, Mr. Robinson. I haven't seen him play since they disposed of Hopkins a few weeks back. He can shoot the rock. That guy can bring it. Two things that stood out in this game. Robert Morris looked tired. That overtime win over Utah to get to the NCAA tournament, I think, took a lot of starch out of their shirt. And Delaware, I think, played with a big chip on their shoulder. A lot of the Blue Hen faithful thought they should have been able to get to the, you know, first round of the NCAA tournament without the playing game by virtue of their head-to-head win over St. Joe's earlier this year. A lot of people in the blue and gold thought that the Hawks should have played in this playing game. But as it is, they're the ones that hosted it, and they made quick work of the Colonials, and now they get a date with Georgetown.
Yeah, so let's move on to the weekend games. There are 8 games to preview. All of these games will be available on ESPNU and streaming on the ESPN network. And every team and every season has a story, Dixie. So let's look at these teams in the matchups and a little bit individually and how they got there as well. It starts on Saturday, May 14th at noon. Boston University, 12-4 on the season, a great season in Boston. The Patriot League champs will travel to Princeton, New Jersey to take on the number 5 seeded Tigers, 9-4 overall, started the season, incredible performances early, including a win over Georgetown. They received an at-large bid. They had a strong RPI. They were in the top 10 most of the season. They finished with an RPI of 3. Boston U, Princeton, this is a rematch from earlier in the season.
And you know, we had Ryan Poley on our show a couple weeks ago, and speaking with him and also getting to know the BU program better this year, I mean, it's hard to believe that this program is only, what, 10 or 11 years old?
Nine years old.
Yeah. I mean, he has done a terrific job, and hats off for winning a very entertaining, very competitive Patriot League tournament, beating Army. That's another team. Maybe the Black Knights have a beef not getting into the NCAAs, but that's, we've already gone through all that. But I think it's going to be disappointing not to watch Brendan Nechtern play another collegiate game. He's terrific. But and then you got Princeton, who is well rested, missed the Ivy League tournament. So I look back at their meeting on April 9th, and Princeton led that game the whole way, but the fourth quarter is where they pulled away from the Terriers. If you look at that game statistically, shots were even, faceoffs were virtually even. Both got double digit saves from their goalies. The difference in this game, Chris Brown for Princeton had 7 assists. So they've got to find a way to get in the gloves of Brown. The attack unit of Perfetto, D'Alto, and Lay combined for 4 points.
Wow.
That's it. D'Alto had 2 goals. Lay had a goal and an assist. Double donuts for Perfetto, which this is a team that is a bunch of no names, but the attack are the ones that they get the job done. So I look at this game. If you can get in the gloves of Chris Brown, and then for BU, get their scoring up from the usual suspects, they're going to have a shot in this thing. So this will be a really good first round game.
The 2:30 time slot is occupied by the Richmond Spiders, 11-4 overall, SoCon champions, defeating Jacksonville in the SoCon championship. They'll travel to Philadelphia and take on number 3 seeded Penn Quakers, 10-4 on the season, and the champions of the Ivy League, the toughest league in the country this year. Again, that game is at 2:30.
Were you surprised Richmond beat Jacksonville?
A little bit.
I was texting with some people, and they're like, "Who do you like in the SoCon?" And forever, I just liked Richmond.
And I've been there. Because the experience that they had playing in that and winning it.
I think that comes into play. I do. But hats off to the Spiders. I think we could give a shout out. Their starting goaltender, Zach Vigue, right?
And Gene Vigue's son.
Yeah. Gene Vigue, a Hopkins football legend.
Yeah. Pride of South Jersey.
Yeah, yeah. So we got a former Blue Jays kid playing in the NCAA tournament. And this is a Richmond team. This could be the upset special of the first round.
Ooh.
Penn, it was a little bit of a – it wasn't a total Pyrrhic victory, but they got some guys banged up. You know, James Shipley didn't play in the Big Ten – I'm sorry, the Ivy League championship game. They're banged up right now. Richmond, I mean, obviously tough weekend, but they did have, you know, a battle with High Point, but they handled the Panthers and then, you know, got by the Panthers and then the tough game against Jacksonville. But I think Richmond is just a little healthier right now. And I know it's cliche, but maybe they're the ones playing with house money. Going up against the Ivy League champ, number 3 seed, you know, statistically and 16 wise in the NCAA tournament, best conference. This is where you might have an upset special in this round.
Well, they're experienced. They've been in the tournament before and they're well coached. We know that. And that'll be a great game. 2:30 on ESPNU. The third game of the day, the 5:00 time slot, St. Joseph's Hawks having their best season ever. 14-3 overall, the NEC champs. They will travel to play number 4 seeded Yale. 11-4 on the season. They earned an at-large berth, RPI of 6. And they'll be waiting for the Hawks.
Yeah. And Terry Foy, amongst other coaches, had Andy Shea and Taylor Ray on this past weekend after the selection show. And it really gives you a view into how focused coaches are on their seasons and on their opponents. When both were asked about each other separately, I don't know anything about St. Joe's. We know nothing about Yale. So obviously that night, that Sunday night, a lot of film work began and prep and yada, yada, yada. Zach Cole for St. Joe's is the great equalizer, I think, in terms of possessions. But, and if they can wear down this Yale defense, they've been giving, you know, Yale's been giving up a lot of goals, especially on the interior. So if St. Joe's can control the flow, control the tempo, and if Yale, you know, they put too much pressure on their goaltender, this, you know, this could be a St. Joe's upset. But I'm thinking, you know, it's not uncommon for Yale. I think that's the fourth time they've lost in the Ivy League championship game. And they just seem to find another gear for the NCAA tournament. So I think that experience, that disappointment of losing the Ivy League championship, I think that might translate into Yale getting the job done.
I think Yale's depth and experience are going to help them in this game.
I think you're right. It's still going to be a great game. Hats off to St. Joe's. First NCAA tournament appearance, right? I mean, we talked to Coach Ray a few weeks ago, and it just seemed like the only, you know, they would go into the Northeast Conference tournament seeded one, and they would get knocked off. And kudos to them for pulling it through this year. Hawk Hill was electric on Saturday. I think there were thousands of people watching that championship game. I want to say close to 2,000 people were at that championship game. Something special. Yeah.
And that's where I take it back to earlier when I said that having new teams in the tournament, new fan bases, it's exciting and it's good for the game. I think long-term it's good for the game.
How about the environment at Vermont for the play-in game this week? That was all. I mean, Terry Foy shared a picture of that. That was off the charts.
Well, it's also maybe the first time the temperature has been above 40 degrees in 6 months.
Whatever. What does it matter? I mean, you know, 2,000. There was 2,000 people on Hawk Hill this weekend. Unbelievable.
That's awesome. That's great. Well, I expect a lot of people to be in Providence, Rhode Island on Saturday night for Virginia, the two-time defending national champions, who finished the regular season 11-3. They have earned an at-large bid. They had an RPI of 9, and they will play the number 8 seeded Brown Bears, 10-5 on the season, who earned the number 1 seed in the Ivy League tournament. They had an at-large berth and finished with an RPI of 10 in the regular season. That game is at 7:30 on ESPNU.
Brown Bear.
Lots of storylines.
Yeah. I mean, you know, first off, the lineage or the link between Charlottesville and Providence. Dom Starcia, former Brown head coach, goes down to University of Virginia, and Brown player, Dom Starcia, teammates with our buddy Jeff Wag. Shout out Jeff Wagner. And then Lars Tiffany, former Brown player, former Brown coach, goes to the University of Virginia. And now, you know, back up at Providence. And that was one of the last games of 2020, Brown and Virginia. It was up at Stevenson Field, and Brown beat them. Or Phil Goss had like 20 plus saves for the Bears to win that game. So this is a Brown team that, you know, I think they're probably disappointed with their showing in the Ivy League semifinal last weekend, fell behind to Penn 6-0 and fought back, but, you know, had just dug themselves too deep of a hole. I think they're going to show up this weekend. Virginia, they've had over 2 weeks off. I think the rest will do them good. They were banged up, but I think now they're healthier, if not healthy. And this is going to be a fun game. If you look at the DNA of both these teams, up and down, frenetic pace, a lot of athletes, ton of offense. This will be the nightcap. You know, ESPN programs these games, schedules these games based upon, for the most part, especially that Saturday night primetime game is considered to be the best game of the first round. So Brown and Virginia could potentially be the best game of the first round.
Yeah, I agree. And I've mentioned it before, there's nothing that motivates you more than when you're the host of a conference tournament or a tournament and you lose a semifinal game. Mm. You got to go back out there and have other teams playing for a championship on your field. Nothing motivates you more than that. And I expect this to be possibly the best game of the first round. That's only half the game, Sticks. We still have
another round of games to go.
On Sunday, May 15th, the Vermont Catamounts, who we talked about, coming off of a 15-3 win over Manhattan on Wednesday. They're 12-6 on the season. They started the season 2-6, ran the table in the America East in the regular season, won the America East Championship, and have earned the right to play the number one seeded Maryland Terrapins. And speaking of running the table, no one has done it better than Terps this season. They're 14-0, ran roughshod over the Big Ten this season, won the Big Ten Championship last weekend, had a slew of players selected in the PLL draft, and they are a juggernaut. They will take on Vermont at noon on Sunday on ESPNU.
And this will be the Bernhardt brothers round two versus each other. Jake Bernhardt, offensive coordinator for Vermont, Jesse Bernhardt, defensive coordinator for Maryland. They met a year ago in the NCAAs with Maryland winning 17-11. You're right about Maryland, prohibitive favorite. I mean, they got to be a 2-1 favorite going into this thing to win an NCAA championship.
Impressive. I think Lax reference had some stat today. I think they have a 36 or 38% chance to win the championship.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Which is high for any
12. Oh yeah, field. Sure. Yeah. Especially when you're looking at a field of 16, you know, at this point. So I don't think they were particularly sharp against Hopkins on Thursday night, but against Rutgers, whenever the Scarlet Knights would pose a challenge, Maryland just had an answer. They just quick strike. They're just relentless, you know? So they're the team to beat, you know, obviously in the NCAAs. Can Vermont do it? You mentioned their start to this season. What's that? 2-6, 2-7.
Yeah. 2-6
to start the year. But, you know, losses to Duke, lost to Penn State, lost to Brown, lost to UMass. You know, that's a nice schedule right there. And that gets you, battle tested for your conference. And they faced a challenge from UMBC. They had beaten the Retrievers back, you know, about a month ago, 12-3, and they were down at halftime to UMBC in this America East Championship game. So experience matters. Just like wins matter, experience matters. And I think this time around, Vermont's not going to be as, I don't want to say in awe, that's probably not the right term, but like walking into Maryland Stadium, playing on Capital One Field, they may have been a little starstruck last year with the stage. That's not going to be the case this year. But with that being said, Maryland, they're still the team to beat. It's going to be an interesting game.
In the 2:30 slot, Ohio State, 10-5, number three in the Big Ten pretty much all season, at large berth. RPI of 14. They will play at number 7 seed Cornell, 11-4 overall, at large berth, RPI of 8. Games at 2:30, and this is a rematch from earlier in the season.
Second rematch game in the first round. You know, you got Princeton and BU kick things off. This was a really competitive game back on March 5th. In Ithaca, Ohio State got out to a 3-0 lead in the first quarter that Cornell ran off 7 in the second quarter to take a 7-4 halftime lead. And then more battling back by Ohio State. It was 10-9 going into the fourth. And then Cornell just won the fourth quarter, 4-2 to take that 14-11 victory. Again, stats very similar in this game. Both 11 saves, 10 saves, shots 41-35, Cornell. Clears were sloppy for Ohio State, 12 out of 19 in that game. That's unacceptable, really, at the Division I level. And Gavin Adler was fantastic in this game. He held Jack Myers to one goal, to 1 point in this game. And then Jackson Reed only had 1 point. Those are the – that's thing one and thing two for Ohio State. So, to me, Ohio State being cleaner, limiting the turnovers and the failed clears, don't give this attack unit, who's incredibly talented, don't give Piatelli and company second chance possessions. And Jack Myers is going to have to, I mean, he's been fantastic all year. He is a legitimate Towariton finalist candidate, no question. I think when you're looking at the people that might be invited to DC, I think it's Wisnowskis, Gray, Nick Turn, Jack Myers. And I think it remains to be seen that fifth. And Myers, too, I think, dependent upon his performance in the tournament, in the NCAA tournament. But if it were to be today, I think I'd invite Myers to D.C. For that ceremony. This is going to be a good one. This will be a good one.
Harvard, 8-4 on the season, at-large berth, had an RPI of 15. Controversial to some, not controversial to others. They will play number 6 seeded Rutgers, 13-3 overall, at-large berth. For the Scarlet Knights, they had an RPI of 5. The game's at 5:00. Before we talk about this game and break it down, let's bring in our guest this week, friend of the pod, Harvard head coach, Jerry Byrne. Our guest this week is Harvard head coach, Jerry Byrne. Coach Byrne, welcome into the D-Fly and Dixie podcast.
I know. I think it's my first time back since right after I got hired.
We did. Yeah, we had you on right after you got the job. And that's kind of a good starting point. You know, how about getting a job and then having a season shut down by a worldwide pandemic? What's the journey been like for Jerry Byrne and the Harvard?
It's kind of like getting invited to a party and you walk in and all of a sudden the needle is scratched across the record. Like, who invited that guy? So it's, you feel like I've been asked that versions of that question. It's a very relevant one. Is, you know, I try not to get upset about things that are out of my control. I think that comes with just being older and accepting, you know, the serenity prayer, just being like, stuff happens, you know, and that was our mantra from the get-go was, all right, what do we do now? And We didn't mourn for too long, and we knew we had a lot to do in recruiting and kind of defining what was the history of Harvard lacrosse and where do we see it going. So all of the kind of effort and energy and activities went toward that. But you know, try not to look back too much, other than the lessons of past mistakes. You can't kind of relitigate that. And so we were just about today.
When you look at the 2022 season, you get a full season in and you get together with your staff at the beginning of the year. Now we're on the precipice of the first round of the NCAA tournament, which you guys are a part of. And we'll talk about that throughout this conversation. But when you looked at this group, what were the goals and what were the ones that you're like, we can definitely attain these goals, but these might be a little bit more lofty?
You know, I try not to kind of, you know, manage or lead like a human successory poster. You know, I'm trying to keep things simple. And because I think the simple solution is often the best one, is that the main and probably only goal was one or two things. Let's find out individually and collectively how good we can be. And because they had had a couple of rough years and some particularly rough games in 2018 and 2019, where they you know, kind of took some games on the chin, is we need to learn how to compete. We need to learn. You need to learn how to be in those games. If you're winning, and this is the way I crafted it, if you're winning, you need to figure out how to close somebody out. If you're losing, you need to figure out how to hunt and close, you know, narrow the gap. And then when you have those two situations, you're in the process of learning how to win, because I think that's as much of a skill as catching and throwing an extra man. And some teams across a variety of sports find ways to win in a 50-50, one team wins, one team lose, win 70-80% of the time. That's culture, and that's coaching, and that's recruiting, and that's attitude and personality and technique, all those things. And we need to do that faster. And so even in the first, you know, the first four games that I coached in 2020, all one goal games, 1-2, lost two, we're winning some and held somebody off. You know, we were losing some, hunted them down to chances to kind of tie on the last possession. So that was kind of, I think, an indicator culturally and kind of affirmation of what we had done from a coaching and a culture standpoint. And then you take that March until we started playing again was the continuation of that. You know, you have such a small sample of games. You think you're doing a lot of the right things. And then we played a bunch of scrimmages. We did really well against High Point and Richmond this past fall, which, you know, again, I know, listen, the scoreboard's on. And people will tell you that, well, you know, like we're trying to, yeah, you get into the fourth quarter and you might have been like, and this is true of me and every other coach, yeah, we're going to sub in some guys. It's a close game. You're like, F that. We're playing to win this thing because I don't want people out there talking about how we lost some scrimmage, you know? So everybody does that. I don't care who you are, is that, you know, we had some progress in those scrimmages. And then, you know, but that was the same mantra, Mark, which was, we need to be in these games. And you know, we were able to come back against Princeton. We were able to not hold the lead with 3 minutes left to go against, hit a crossbar against Yale to go up 2, and we ended up losing that game. So progress, but it starts with, you need to be in a lot of those games to become good at winning, either coming back or holding somebody off or pulling away. And my whole philosophy is, if you're up by 1, win by 2. If you're up by 2, win by 3. That you're not going to win games with passivity. And we have a lot of young guys who kind of really embrace that mindset. And so that's really the goal. Find out how good you can be. And that takes work and vision and execution and all the things that go into that. But also, let's learn how to win these games. But starts with being in those games.
You mentioned the young part of your team. Your 5 of your top 8 scorers are freshmen. So how do you have a 2-year layoff, more or less, building this culture and then incorporate all these young people into it and still come out 8-4 playing in the NCAA tournament for the first time in several years?
You know, I think that has a lot to do with, you know, I think my assistants, Neil Hutchinson, Will Corrigan, Ted Bergman, Lars Kyle, is that, you know, all the stuff that's going on before you walk out of the locker room onto the practice field. Our strength coach does a great job. All that stuff that was going on from the middle of March when our season got canceled. We had guys who had moved in with each other for months here and there, small groups of 3 or 4 guys who were doing training and lifting and one-on-ones and small group stuff, as a lot of teams were doing, you know, whether you were in San Francisco or Long Island or Southern California or wherever, like guys were finding each other, you know, through text chains or, you know, and so that happened at a really high level within our program. We were feeding them the tools. We didn't over Zoom. We did very few. I think we probably did in the time from March 2020 till September 2021. I think we did like 7 team Zooms. I was like, these guys are on Zoom all the time. When we do something, I want it to be, you know, I want them locked in and dialed in. So kind of gave them, you know, a MapQuest map of a variety of ways to get to where they want to be when they come back. And, but that I think they also got together as a group. I had nothing, you know, I couldn't coordinate it. I really had no desire because I'm a big believer in kind of the organic nature of you know, the person in charge pointing the where you're trying to get to, having some milestones along the way and you know, checking points and letting guys figure out solutions. You know, this is the leaders and the best here at Harvard, future CEOs and Supreme Court justices and senators is you're going to have to do that someday. Why not figure it out now in the middle of this, in the middle of the pandemic? So one of the things that did about 30 of our guys went down to Atlanta. So about 65% of our team went and lived together for 5 or 6 weeks and trained. And so what it also did was it helped them to see some of our, you know, future guys were going to be really good. And so they acknowledged their skill and their ability. And so that when we got on the field, it wasn't some like Jets and the Sharks West Side Story, like, hey, here's the upperclassmen, here's the underclassmen, we're in this battle. It's like, no, those guys had validated their ability already and in some ways had kind of integrated themselves as well. And so, and, you know, if you're smart and not selfish, you have to acknowledge skill. And our young guys are talented and hungry and confident. And, you know, not that they deferred, but they figured out we can be better if we figure out how to work together versus kind of competing against each other in that way of class versus class.
You're a big hip hop guy. And I know we've shared a lot of laughs over the years comparing music. Selection Sunday, going into the selection show, what would your hip hop song in your head be versus after you hear Harvard is going to the dance? What were the two songs?
I didn't have a song in my head. I live a couple of miles from campus, and so as I was driving in, I was more kind of thinking about, all right, senior dinner, you know, how am I going to coordinate with those guys before they graduate? All the administrative stuff, summer workouts, you know, meetings before they go, all the, you know, the bureaucratic admin stuff that you have to do, but also you want to do because you need to, you know, like an Irish wake, you know, you're like, all right, he's not here with us anymore, but it doesn't mean we can't have, you know, start thinking about the future as well. And so, but, you know, one of our songs after wins that I would play was, and I think it's one of the great hip hop songs of all time is, you know, Hit It, Love It by 50 Cent and G Unit with The Game. You know, it's a great song. It's a great kind of, you know, Hit It or Love It, the underdog's on top, you know? And so not that we're on top, but we're still alive. So that song has been kind of a theme of, you know, kind of an underdog's mentality, you know, a sense of that Harvard's maybe history is not as blue-blooded as a bunch of teams in our league and some of the teams that are historically really talented. So, you know, having a little underdog chip that can be, you know, embodied in that song has been a theme of ours. So ironically, after all the hoopla died down on their own, they put that song on in the locker room.
That's awesome. So I'm real interested in the week that you had between your loss to Yale and finding out that you're in the NCAA tournament. You were in the mix with several other teams for the last couple of spots. You had wins over Princeton and Brown, top 8 seeds. So you had to feel pretty good. You also beat BU. You had some really good wins. But how do you motivate the guys, keep them interested, keep them that week between Yale and the selection Sunday?
And factoring in that, you know, finals at Harvard is spread out over like 12 days. Yeah, they have some reading days and, it, you know, they have final exams on Saturdays too. So, you know, so you start with that is that, you know, and there's NCAA rules about off days and things like that. So you start with, you know, we had all their exam schedules, their papers and their group projects. And, you know, the Harvard has a tremendous amount of resources for extra help and whatnot. And so, you know, I always want to start from there because I want them to have a deep respect and affinity for this place. I don't want them to be mercenaries. I want them to bring the same excellence they bring to wanting to be a really good player and teammate to everything here. Because how sad would that be to come to a place like this and not take the great professors, not take the great, you know, Nobel laureates of, that are, you know, peppered throughout campus. You should want to do that. It comes with a sacrifice, Dan. Like, you have to give up some social elements. You have to give up things to be a really good student, a really good person, and to want to be a really good player and teammate. So they knew that I would come from that perspective and respect of their exams. And I also had told them that I didn't know what the outcome is in the locker room after Yale, is that, you know, let's work off the assumption that we're going to be in the tournament. And so, and I also told them that, you know, when we go out on the field, we'll be out there for 80 to 90 minutes, including stretching and stick handling and things like that. So we'll do some teaching, not overdo it, because they're, you know, really prideful about school, and this is a competitive place, is that I want them to do really well. But I also told them that this is crazy healthy. Like, if you're doing what you should be doing, getting this 2-hour break between kind of walking over here and training room and doing, like, getting that break, and we, you know, have food for them and whatnot, is that's super healthy. That's going to make you so much more energized to go back and study, you know, after practice. And so we worked around their exam schedules. We didn't do any film, and we did that 80 minutes. We did a bunch of, we played for, you know, 25 to 30 minutes, you know, straight play. So we kept our conditioning up, and we stepped back a little bit so guys could bring the energy of not a pickup game. Like, I mean, it was crazy competitive, and we filmed everything, but that they could get a little bit of that juice and that energy out there. And then we ended the week with an inter-squad game where the seniors drafted the players, and we wore different unis. And so we led up to that, and our team impact signee Braxton came to a bunch of practices. So we were able to get a little perspective, energy. We played, we taught a little bit, but not too much. And then they were able to kind of go on. And as coaches, we stepped back. We weren't yelling and screaming and coaching every little micro element that they were able to, like, you know, not that it was pickup, but, you know, pickup basketball is one of the great things of just energy and competitiveness, and you can play with a little more freedom and stuff like that. So, and I think that's healthy for them. So we kept our conditioning and our skills up, but we didn't overdo it.
Six Ivy League teams are in the NCAA tournament, a year removed from no competition in 2021 for these lacrosse teams. How would you best characterize the Ivy Leagues in 2022, having gone through that full season of competition as well as the out-of-conference?
You know, I think it's very reminiscent of, you know, what the ACC typically is year in, year out, you know. Yeah, are there teams that, you know, in that league have an outlier bad season, you know, here and there, but, you know, not consistently. And so you got kind of that feeling, and having coached in that league for a long time, that's kind of what it felt like, is that, you know, on any given Saturday, it was really hard to predict who was going to, you know, win that game. And it was less around parity and more about preparation, experience, you know, what needed to happen, you know, that would, you know, for a team to either make the Ivy League tournament or the NCAA tournament. So it was, you know, it was every week feeling like a, you know, a 15 round kind of Ali Frazier. And because there was so much riding on it, you know, across the whole league. And so, you know, I think much less around the kind of the romantic or the dramatic view of, oh, we didn't get to play. And, oh, you know, we had, you know, all of us, I think, had stopped thinking and talking about that. It was a great narrative and a great story to lean on, that a bunch of teams made the tournament, but it's not what we were focused on. We were, you know, and everybody did a great job of kind of managing their programs during that, whatever, 15, 16 month break that we had. And so it felt like every game was an NCAA tournament game. You know, part of that was the time away, but part of it was that the league was having a great out of conference, you know, one loss record, and being highly ranked, which, you know, the rankings are, you know, that's for marketing purposes and opinions and people yelling at each other. But it was kind of an affirmation of what kind of what we were starting to figure out was, hey, you know, all of us are really good.
Is there any game or moment everybody wants to like look to a turning point or a light bulb moment? Did Harvard lacrosse have that in 2022 with any game or any particular stretch of play?
You know, I think, you know, we went to, I mean, I think there's probably a couple of moments. I think we, you know, we were 7-1 and, you know, we bused to Cornell. There's a lot of rules about travel and it's, you know, I won't bore you with the details and how many people can travel and things. There's a lot of just funky rules that are well-intentioned, but difficult to manage around. But you get to Cornell, we're 7-1 and they were, you know, we were both ranked in the top 10 and they, you know, in the middle of the second quarter, it's 1-1 and then it wasn't, you know, and then it's 10-1. And so, and I was super impressed by them. They played, you know, I told that to Connor Busick, they play hard. They don't say a word. They just really, you know, I think a testament to their program. And I told him as such. And so, you know, nothing clarifies like getting your ass kicked on, you know, on ESPN streaming. It's not even the Ocho. And so the, you know, so that was clarifying for sure. And then, you know, we follow that up with, you know, great game against Penn. We're winning at halftime. It's their senior and alumni day. It's a tremendous thing. We have a nightmare bus, broken bus, you know, not going to get on, complain about that on, you know, social media, but like broken bus traffic in every, you know, we miss all the windows. We hit all the windows we were trying to miss in traffic, you know.
Little planes, trains, and automobiles.
We hit Fairfield County, New York, New Jersey, Philadelphia, just a nightmare, right? But beautiful day, we're winning at halftime. You know, we do a good job against a super talented team, and just we couldn't take that lead and finish it off. And that had happened against Ohio State as well. We were going to get halftime against Ohio State in our second game. But it shows you that, all right, that as we gained experience, we were getting better, you know, and nothing to, you know, you can't coach experience. Experience only comes from experience. I know that sounds like something Yogi Berra would say, but it's like you can do film and drills and all the replication and everything. Nothing teaches like playing. And as our younger guys, and again, we play about 14, 15 freshmen of the 23 guys that play. We start 7 freshmen on our team. Is that as we got more experience, they were getting better, not surprisingly. And so, and then we took that into the comeback against Princeton, that, you know, we needed that game. It was our senior, our first alumni event in, you know, 26 months. First one ever, whether here or in New York City or somewhere else. And, you know, we were able to come back with our alums right there. That was a seminal moment. And then I think we took some of that energy into the Yale game, which was, you know, a winnable game. They made more plays at the end, but, you know, we go look back at that game and said, you know, we were up 1, hit a crossbar to go up 2. You know, it doesn't happen. They come back and tie it. And when we had chances, it wasn't like we were outclassed or couldn't hang with them, we did. And so all of those things, like those 3 or 4 things, I think, but time is the teacher, and time, you know, it ticks how you use it and how you play within it, how you coach within it. But the more and more that we played, the more and more confident and comfortable our team had become.
You guys are in the NCAA tournament. And I don't know if anybody's asked you this question or not, Jerry, but Notre Dame is a team that potentially you guys ousted. And there's been a lot of uproar from the Fighting Irish. That's where you came from. And you know those kids. You recruited a lot of those kids. Has there been any emotional side to that over the last couple of days?
No, listen, the human side of this, you know, you don't disconnect from that. I mean, you know, I coached with Kevin for, you know, 20 years between 2 different stints. So I know what it's like to be in that room and have the joy of that. And that's, you guys know that, is that when your name comes up, whether you knew with certainty that it was happening or whether you had uncertainty and you weren't sure, there's very few moments like that. And the fact that for me, it was, my first year, essentially, like, couldn't be more thrilled for it. My heart was pounding through my chest because, I do this for their happiness solely, and so that was, great. But yeah, there's the inverse of that is knowing so many of those guys out in South Bend and their parents and through recruiting. And I know what a great job Kevin does, that he, should get more credit for how much, how caring he is for their professional development and their personal development. He should get more. He does it as well as anybody. And where I learned to do that at a high level is, they're despondent, I'm sure, because that clearly is, a great team that is capable of winning the national championship. And so, and I texted and heard from, a bunch of their parents and those guys, because I'm still close with them. I don't close that book when I leave. I stay connected with those guys and deeply connected in some cases. So I know what they're feeling, and my heart goes out to them. And I can only imagine what that locker room was like.
Looking to this weekend, at 5 o'clock on Sunday afternoon, you will play Rutgers. You've had a chance now to probably look at some film on the Scarlet Knights. What's it going to take for Harvard to move on to the quarterfinals of the NCAA tournament?
Yeah, I think they are very athletic, and that athleticism and skilled, obviously. But also, going back to Mark's earlier question, and again, it's a cliche, but like they know exactly who they are, situationally and decision-making within situations, but also philosophically. Eric is a really, I coached against Eric Saramet for a long time when he was at Air Force and I was at Notre Dame. So I have a sense of his kind of view of offense, both in the kind of the free flowing element and in the kind of the structured set play stuff. Cause he's, he does a great job at both. So I think overall they know exactly who they are. They're not going to, reinvent themselves to feel like they have to adjust to us in any way. Not that I would think they would anyway, but as far as, what kind of drives success for us in this game. And I think it's true of any team in any game. You have to ride well, you really have to clear well, and the early offense, they're a really good early offense team, and a secondary, early offense, you stop the early offense. And then here's the second wave substitution, patterns and things like that. I don't freak out when we have offensive guys down there playing defense. I'd rather have six guys playing defense than play 5-on-5 or 4-on-4 and things like that. And so I think dealing with their waves of what they do in the kind of early offense and in secondary early offense, and then, dealing with a really skilled, Ross Scott is, as quick as anybody that will play. Bartolo is kind of a Hanley-esque, big cat out on the wing. Brian Cameron is, the guy who's been a Dodger for most of his life, so he can dodge, but also has really developed into a really good end of play inside guy. Knobloch is a super talented. Gallagher, they got both an integrated approach to playing offense, but also a respect for what each of those guys of different sizes and shapes can do. And that comes back to the first thing I said, is that they really know who they are, and they really know situationally when they can make plays within their individual skill set, which is not a lot of teams can do, because that can become kind of selfish and territorial. And, how do they work together? And that's, I think, speaks to what Brian's done. He's gotten these transfers and found a way to integrate them into a really good culture. As far as what we can do is obviously battling at the face off. It's on the surface not a great strength of ours, but we don't look at NCAA statistics and facing off. I look at it the way we looked at it at Notre Dame, which is, are you get, you might win the ground ball, but if you get stripped in one step and we get the ball, that's a win for us. And we happen to have, I think, one of the best LSMs in the country, Greg Cambisi, on our team. So we have, I think guys that can make that happen. And our young guys, you know, this is a big stage for them. Them bringing the confidence and the experience that they developed over the year into this game, those guys are going to continue to make mistakes and plays. Hopefully more plays than mistakes.
Just a couple more for you, Jerry. You mentioned Cambisi. Who are some of the other guys that people need to know about on this Harvard Crimson team? And who are the leaders of your group?
First of all, we got two great seniors, Kyle Mullen, who, I don't know whether he'll be ready this weekend. He got injured in the third quarter of the Yale game, but he's one of the top goalies in the country. And Charlie Ulmer, who's one of our D middies, Charlie's is going to win a bunch of awards here at Harvard. He was one of the 64 finalists for a Rhodes Scholarship. He's a crazy impressive kid. So we got two great leaders, and I think it starts with them because they've been here across a couple of administrations here at Harvard, and that perspective is so important, And then we got a lot of young guys playing. Sam King and Madronic at attack is a really good combo for us. Our first, five or six midfielders are all freshmen. So our first midfield line of Bodkis, who was all Ivy this year as a freshman, Bodkis, Gaffney, and Perry are all, and then our second group of Hills and Rath and Elijah Cohen and Isaiah Dawson, who's a junior, will mix in with that group as well. So we'll do some different stuff with all of those guys. Hayden Cheek is our inside guy, and he's, super talented, super skilled. He had three or four goals against Yale. It's why teams don't want to slide off of us, because Sam and Hayden Cheek have a nice kismet together. So, and then defensively, we'll pretty consistently have, probably five freshmen on defense. Three of our first four D middies are all freshmen, and two of our starting defensemen are freshmen. So, and our first three LSMs are two freshmen and a sophomore. So we got some, but they don't play like freshmen, and that's all that matters.
Coach, switching up just a little bit for the last couple questions. You mentioned that you spent about 20 years in the food capital of North Central Indiana. Now that you're in Boston, have you been able to find any good restaurants there that meet the standards of Indiana?
Oh my goodness.
Food and cuisine.
It's Boston, for New York, I'm a proud New Yorker, but I'm not like a confrontational New Yorker. Like, I'm not like, oh, New York, like, New York is, there's, New York is New York for a reason, but I'm not so like narrow-minded that I'm not open to other, places. And so moving to Boston, I first of all, I love history, and I love American history in particular. And this is where it all started, to be honest with you. So whether it's the Mayflower or the founding in Boston in 1630. And so I love that. And as a result, Boston is a very neighborhoody place, and like every mile or two you're in some new named area, which I think naming areas helps kind of create culture within those places, identity and personality and food and bars and music and things like that. And Cambridge is a crazy cool place. Cambridge is basically a city within Boston, and Cambridge is gigantic. It goes all the way from MIT and downtown Boston all the way to bordering on like Lexington. And it has MIT, probably has 15 colleges within its footprint, right? And so, and Harvard Square in Cambridge, where Harvard is there's 150 places to eat in Harvard Square. So when we're doing recruiting and we like if you're a foodie, there's everything for you. And so it's just a great place to be, not just because of the energy of being at a place like Harvard, but Harvard is also like the school predates Cambridge and most of Boston. So the place built around it versus most schools are, here's the main gate and you walk in and it's walled off and you can see the separation between school and town. Harvard is just like blended in, like a tree and flowers in a lawn and a weed over here. It's just all blended in. And so that's super cool. And I live in the North End of Boston, which is the...
Any good restaurants there?
Oh, yeah. It's, you know, my wife loves to cook, but we go out all the time because it's just, you know, I'm about 120 yards from Hanover Street, which is the main drag of Boston. And so it's everything that you want. And so I feel pretty spoiled. I'm pretty fortunate to live. I live right near Faneuil Hall. I live right on the intersection of the North End and Faneuil Hall, Quincy Market, and down the street from the Garden. So I can walk to see the Celtics tonight and walk into the North End. So pretty blessed. But you know, you got great bagels, you get great bread, you get great Italian, you got great seafood. It's, you know, it's the triple whammy of culinary delights here.
All right, final question. We've been asking all the coaches this season. So season is intense. It's long. It's busy. What does Coach Byrne do to relax? Music guy. We know you're a music guy. But do you watch? There's some shows you watch, movies. What do you like to do? Workout. What is it that Coach Byrne does to when he has a moment to
We compete as a staff. I think familiarity, you know, breeds creativity. You know, again, obviously in the wrong environment, it breeds contempt. But, you know, I have three 30-year-olds and younger guys on my staff, and they keep me young. So we play, we compete all the time and talk. We give it to each other pretty good. We keep a track of the squash ladder. We play basketball. We do shooting contests and stuff. So I give it as well as I take it, you know, because, you know, I got my ass kicked in these games right next to the other guys. So we compete, we have meals together, our wives and girlfriends have become close. I think that camaraderie, your players see that, and it means you can have disagreements that don't become kind of like rifts and fissures. I don't think I know everything. I know I don't see everything, and I know I don't know everything. So a collaborative approach, I think, creates creativity and real progress. And I think our players recognize that. And I think that's been a big part of our success, is of how well we work together and spend time together. And I love their energy and they're fun and smart and crazy hardworking. As far as like by myself, my wife works a lot. So I still have a lot of time by myself. I'm a big history buff. I watch documentaries. I love getting into subjects that deal with kind of creativity and production and pathways to whatever success, whatever you might define success as. And I love thought provoking, not necessarily social justice, but politics and intersection of politics and government and culture and how that reflects on society. That's a big part of the way Harvard views the world, is that, you know, our guys and gals are going to leave here and go on and have impacts in their community. And so during the pandemic, we watched a bunch of a variety of documentaries that I think were compelling and were thought provoking. And so I like to immerse myself like everybody else in a good show that kind of draws you in, whether, you know, but I typically like nonfiction and real world stuff. And more recently watching documentaries on the making of some of the great albums of all time. I know albums is going to date me, but that's just super interesting. to me. Like, I didn't listen to Pink Floyd when I probably should have been listening to Pink Floyd in the 70s. I was not listening to Pink Floyd. I was listening to kind of punk and new wave, but I've become a fan of that. And, you know, learning how they made some of their great albums is super interesting to me. The writing, the production, the engineering of it. And, you know, on the surface, you can look at some of these rock stars and be like, oh, that guy's a vapid, shallow, you know, dilettante, you know, self-absorbed. And then you come out and then you listen to the, you know, Roger Waters talking about, you know, writing Shine On You Crazy Diamond. And you're like, man, I want to hang out with that guy. You know, so I like to be surprised. I guess I like to be surprised.
Recommendation if you haven't seen it. Have you seen The Defiant Ones?
Of course.
About Dr. Dre and Jimmy Iovine. Just fantastic.
Just, you know, like all of that stuff. Like people think like, oh, you wrote a great hook and then you became famous. And, you know, like the effort that it takes to create something indelible, like The Chronic, for example. Yeah. Like, you know, you think that just happens, you know? I mean, that takes, you know, just like it takes a guy, you know, hours and hours to shoot on the run and hit the corner, like the amount of time that those guys sat with their hunched over a, you know, composition notebook. It's, you know, I love getting into that.
Well, you will have a chance to put your stamp on how you are building the culture and program of Harvard Lacrosse on Sunday afternoon. We wish you the best of luck in the NCAA tournament. And thank you so much for your time on the D-Fly and Dixie podcast.
Thank you, fellas. Hopefully we won't wait 3 years for my next invite.
Good luck, coach. Yeah. Great to sit down with Coach Byrne.
Really thoughtful answers. You know, in particular, I really wanted to ask him that Notre Dame question. That's got to be hard, the human element in that.
It's a good, thoughtful answer.
Low key, Dave Petromala and his staff, former staff at Hopkins, were in attendance at the Hopkins Maryland game this past weekend to support the seniors. The boys that they recruited and coached, they were there and they were off the radar, but they were there. So that's, and I only say that, I only bring that up to talk about and compare it to what Coach Byrne probably felt. Guys he recruited, guys he coached, knowing that Harvard getting that spot, Notre Dame was one of the teams that was bumped out. So it has to be somewhat emotional, but then, hey, you know, you're left and you've got an opportunity, and this is a really young Harvard team. I think we've talked about it a lot in this space that, you know, they're probably a year or two away, and this opportunity arrived a little earlier. So hats off to the Crimson. I'm not super excited that there are six Ivy teams in this tournament. Are we going to see how good the Ivies are, or is it just going to turn into an extended Ivy League tournament? We'll wait and see. Rutgers covered those guys a lot. They just cannot beat Maryland for whatever reason. But I think every time they lose to Maryland, they refocus, they recalibrate, they get pissed. And I know the Scarlet Knights are incredibly excited to be hosting a first round NCAA game. It will be on USAC Field, which is their grass surface, beautiful soccer stadium. Graduation is taking place at SHI. That's a little disadvantage to Rutgers, because how many coaches have told us when you play in that stadium, it's just different.
Are they going to have the train whistle? And
they got the siren or the horn. Yeah.
Okay. They have that at your cap.
Yeah. You know what? They got to get it there some way, somehow, but it's not going to hit the same.
The NCAA might not let that happen. The NCAA may have to, because it's, you know, more neutral. They may not allow that anyway. That kind of.
Yeah, that makes sense. NCAA, you know.
No fun.
They're such fun, those guys. And I think what's really stark about this game, Dan, is the age difference in these teams. I mean, you're talking about 27 seniors on Rutgers team.
That's insane. That is ridiculous. And they can do it during graduation. Like, I can't.
Yeah.
But you also feel,
and then like, you got the playpen of Harvard.
I think five of their top eight scorers are freshmen.
Right.
Wow.
But a guy like Sam King is not really a freshman. He's really, I mean, he's a 2020 grad, but you know, college lacrosse wise, he is a freshman.
Yeah. Should be a good game. I'm looking forward to seeing that.
No doubt.
It'll be, you know, how Coach Byrne tries to slow down the NASCAR offense, and the scheming will be fascinating in this game.
I mean, I tell you what, I mean, Harvard was in a shootout against Yale. They can score goals. Had to score a lot of goals against Princeton, too, to get that win. So,
and the final matchup of the weekend, Delaware Blue Hens, 12-5 on the season, the champions of the Colonial Athletic Association, coming off of a 20-8 win over Robert Morris on Wednesday, will travel to D.C., take on the number 2 seeded Georgetown Hoyas, 15-1, Big East champions, who, if it's possible, they kind of are flying under the radar, just sitting down there waiting. And a lot of talk about Maryland, a lot of talk about teams who got in or didn't get in. And the Hoyas, are they getting the respect that they deserve, Dixie?
Georgetown is the new Denver. What I mean by that is they have some high-profile out-of-conference games in the beginning of the season. Then they go into their conference schedule. The Big East does not have a TV deal. They're not on television. In order to get Big East, you have to go through some FACACTA third party, something or other.
Slow sports.
I don't know what it is, but I remember I looked into getting the Georgetown Hopkins game. I'm like, no thanks, man. Like, no thanks. Thankfully, the Loyola Georgetown game was on CBS Sports Network, but they do not have a TV deal, or the Big East doesn't. So much like Denver used to disappear and then pop back up in the NCAA tournament, I feel like Georgetown has become that team, although they've been a steady number 2, number 3 team in the media poll all year. This is a good team. I mean, this is a very good team. Not particularly deep. They don't play a ton of guys. We'll see how that plays out. But you have to imagine, you know, the big boot in the shorts that they got last year in the quarterfinals against Virginia. If they win this game, we'll talk about that next week. But I think that playoff experience, you know, as negative as that quarterfinal was, they learned from it and they're better for it. And this is Delaware again, they've got a chip on their shoulder. You know, they feel like they shouldn't have had to have played that play-in game. This is going to be a tall task for the Blue Hen, short rest, going to DC, playing against a team that faces off really well, gets great goaltending, stingy physical defense, really an offense that is among the best in the country. Kevin Warren used to be an assistant at Delaware years ago. So a little bit of a subplot, if you will, there. But, you know, I think you have to take the Hoyas in this game.
That rounds out the 8 NCAA tournament games. Lots. I can't wait to watch. I hope it rains all week. Sit on my couch and watch this game and not have to worry about yard work or whatever. My own children lacrosse games, things like that. It'll be great. I can't wait to watch these games. So make your plans now. And I'm looking forward to talking about these games next week, Dixie, and recapping them and previewing them next week.
Faux show.
All right, Dix. We were talking to Coach Byrne. Matt brought up food a little bit, and he talked about the north end of Boston. And one time we were there for the NCAA championships that were at Patriots Stadium.
Foxborough, Gillette
Stadium. And we were staying in Boston, and I had one of the best Italian meals I've ever had. I don't remember the name of the restaurant, but I want to get your opinion on pasta. We're going to talk about pasta right now. I'm not talking about anything you can put inside of it. So no raviolis, no tortellini, no anything else that you can stuff. No, even like manicotti, you know, like that, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about if you're making pasta or you got this in your cabinet, and you always make sure you have it. How would you rank pasta, your favorites? Again, I don't mean lasagna. I mean the noodles, because there's lots of different kinds. Most people are familiar with spaghetti, maybe macaroni, but what are your favorite kind? I have a ranking. I put a lot of thought into this, actually. Maybe way too much thought. But these are my top five. These are my top five. My number five is cavatappi, which is, you know, like spirally tubular pasta that I, when I make homemade macaroni and cheese, that's what I use. It sort of catches the cheese, or if you, I've made lobster macaroni and cheese before, and it's just perfect for that. It's long, spiral. It's way better than macaroni for making macaroni and cheese, but that's what I use.
What's it called again?
Cavatappi.
Cavatappi. Marol.
Second, or number four, I should say, is farfalle. Farfalle pasta or bow ties, you know, like bow tie pasta.
Oh yeah, bow tie.
They're pasta. Great. You can put it. You can make like pasta salad. You can serve like with a vodka sauce and chicken. I mean, there's lots of different things you can do. You can make it with an Alfredo, with broccoli. But it's a nice thing, and my kids like it too because it's a little bit different. Number three, tagliatelle.
Jeez whiz.
So like the long, like fettuccine is too narrow, so it's like the long flat stuff, and parpadele is too wide. Those are the wide ones for tagliatelle. And I like the tagliatelle. It's great for, I'd make this thing like a pork ragu, again, a slow cooker, and you serve it over these tagliatelle nests. It's so good. It's so good.
Wow.
Number two, cappellini. So if I'm going for like a spaghetti, I prefer that over regular spaghetti. It's like a little too wide. And angel hair, I love, but it's a little bit thinner. So cappellini is my number two. And my number one, my go-to, that I buy boxes of it at a time.
Chef Boyardee.
Penne pasta. Penne is the best. It's so versatile. It's so good. It's thick. It's hearty. Make anything with it just about. And it's like, I have to beg my kids to use penne instead of regular spaghetti because my daughter just wants to eat spaghetti all the time. I'll be like, Amy, ask Hannah if she'll go for penne today and not spaghetti. But those are my five, top five. And there were a lot of choices. I understand that, but those are my favorites.
Yeah. All right. So I'm not a gigantic pasta guy, but I do like a good pasta. And I like there's a nice restaurant, Catonsville, called Franco's, that's on Frederick Road that does a nice job. My favorite used to be DeMimo down in Little Italy. Oh. God, what a awesome, awesome place DeMimo was back in the day.
Yeah, maybe one of the nicest restaurants, if not the best, in Little Italy, would you say?
It became my favorite. I know everybody talks about, you know, Sabatino's, Cipriani's, which are great places, but they oftentimes become tourist traps almost.
Yes.
Whereas DeMimo was, you know, it was just, man, what a great place.
Great.
That was. Right. So my pastas. Okay. Let me put my thinking cap on. I'm not as sophisticated as you when it comes to pasta. I do love angel hair pasta. I love the fact that you can just like twist it, just get like a nice big mouthful if you got like a cream sauce on it or a lemon sauce or
bolognese.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the stuff. That's the stuff. I do like pappardelle. I do like the wide pasta every now and again, especially with a nice hearty meat sauce.
Yeah.
You know, something along those lines, a nice, you know, piece of Italian bread, you know, you stick in there, all that good stuff. But I think my favorite is rigatoni. And I love vodka sauce. So I love a vodka rigatoni with some chicken on there, sausage, something of that nature. I love vodka sauce. Oh my God. It's my favorite. So good. So those would be mine. Those would be mine. Again, I'm not a gigantic pasta guy.
Yeah.
But those would be mine.
I'm a fan. And as I've gotten older and traveled and eaten a little bit better, I guess I'm like, oh, there's more than just this and that.
You know? Yeah.
This other thing I make this, it's bucatini pasta. So it's
okay.
It's spaghetti, but it's thicker and it's hollow.
Yeah.
And they in Rome, they make this like pasta. It's pepper and cheese and that's it. And it's the simplest thing. You can make it in like 10 minutes at home, and it is just so good. But they serve it as like an appetizer, and that mm-hmm. is a nice thing that I really like too. And then, I mean, I've been buying these raviolis that are just so good, and my children don't like them. So Amy and I just eat these cheese raviolis that are
so good. Now cheese hungry. Ravioli, you can like almost eat like potato chips sometimes.
Yeah,
like,
my beef though is if you go, I never get them in a restaurant because they'll give you like 4 or 5.
Right.
And you're like, I need 15 of these. Don't want, you know, you go to like a lobster ravioli and you get 3 on your plate. You're like, wait a mm-hmm. second. I lost. My wife got that meal over there and there's just more food. I want that. So yeah, raviolis are delicious.
Looks like you're hungry now. I mean, it's past lunchtime when we're recording this, but you might be making your way over to the trattoria.
I'm going to go to Roma's, and it's a little closer. All right. We'd like to thank our guest this week, Harvard coach Jerry Byrne. Best of luck this week in the tournament and through the postseason. Good luck. If you like what you heard, please like us on your favorite podcast app and leave a review. Tell a friend and share the love. It's free. We went overtime today, Dix. This is a long one. Yeah. A long one. So, you know, show us some love.
You wouldn't shut up in the beginning. You were on a rant.
I was, man. I couldn't believe what I was seeing on Sunday night. It was disappointing.
If you can't get it off your chest here, where can you?
It was disappointing to me. I just couldn't believe what people were saying. I just couldn't believe it. We always love to hear from you. Give us a shout out on Twitter. He's at Dixon Lacrosse, and I'm simply at D_FLY. Remember, stay positive, test negative, and as always, enjoy the games.
I guess what I'm getting at is, hold on, what am I getting at?